Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
And we are back. Hello, everybody. Ciao a tutti. This is the Wild Wild Podcast. And unlike last time, I'm going to remember to start straight away by saying hello. This is Adrian Smith. And with me, as ever, is Rod Barnett. Hello, Rod.
Hello, Adrian. How are you doing? Well, I already kind of know how you're doing. So.
I'm totally fine. I'm getting more professional now, too, look. yes. Yeah, I got COVID again. I mean, like, we all just kind of moved on, didn't we? And, like, that was all such a long time ago and everyone's forgotten about it. But no, it's still around and here I am. But anyway, I'm fine. So maybe this will be the last episode. Oh, that'd be bad, wouldn't it? I should.
Oh, don't say that. That's no.
I'll cut that out. Or will I?
Mm. No. No. Leave it just, in because then it's then it's failed prophecy if we're lucky. Yeah. So.
Yes. Like Bronx Warriors and Vic Moreau.
Yes, I wondered if that was going to be a topic of conversation. I figured
we'll have to talk about that. So, Rod, what have you been up to since last we spoke on the podcast?
Podcasting.
You've had at least 15 episodes out since our last one, I think.
Oh, I don't know about that. I just finished editing one that'll be out here in a couple of days. That's a new Beyond Nashy episode with Troy and I being joined again by the illustrious Bob Sargent as we talk about a movie with a few Nashy connections, but mostly it's just an incredibly weird trashy film from Eurocine from 1970, Orloff and the Invisible Monster, which
nice.
Yeah, it's a We have a very long discussion. The episode turned out to be about 2 hours and 45 minutes long, but that includes a lot of emails, so thank goodness. But
yeah. Is the invisible monster a chimp?
You know what? It does turn. And this is a spoiler, folks. So you know if you're a cinema purist, hands over your ears so that you're not going to hear this. But it does turn out to be an invisible gorilla or ape man. So keep that in mind.
Oh, I didn't mean to spoil it for you. There we go.
Honestly, how can you spoil a movie with the qualities of Orloff and the Invisible Monster? Or Orloff against the Invisible Monster?
It's funny, in the my conversation with Luigi Cozzi, we did actually end up talking about Mr. Super Invisible.
Oh my God, are you kidding?
No.
How did that happen?
If you haven't listened...
I haven't heard it yet. I need to listen to it.
Yeah. So that for anyone else who hasn't heard that yet, towards the end of the conversation, I ask him about his relationship with Antonio Margheriti. And surprisingly, Mr. Super Invisible is the film that comes up in conversation. So.
Oh my goodness. Okay. Got to listen to that today.
Worth listening. The sound quality isn't great, but it's hopefully you can, you know, it's manageable. But anyway, yeah, it was really fun to actually talk to him. The conversation at first was a bit slow and I was a bit worried about how well it was going to go and how But he's got pretty good English, I think, but I wasn't sure if he could just not hear me very well or whatever. And so the answers were kind of two or three words and then silence. And I thought, oh, this is going to be rubbish. But actually, once we got going, he was really chatty and it was really fun. We had to stop a couple of times because he had customers in the shop. but yeah, it was really great. And it's making me think now about other people I need to try and track down and interview for the podcast as well. So if anyone's got any leads out there and anybody you think we should try and get on here whilst they're still around, then that would be, maybe that's something I could work on as a side project. But anyway, so we are into our sort of dystopian future, speculative future, post-apocalypse type thing. And this film is arguably the highlight and is only the second one in. So it's a bit of a worry.
I know what you're talking about. I know why you're saying that, because this is an incredibly entertaining film. But
yeah,
I don't know. I'm wondering what revisiting these movies is going to feel like, long term as we go through them. This is going to be, it's going to be an interesting experiment at the very least.
Yes, that's it. Yeah, this is, I don't know if these films were necessarily designed to be watched in close succession.
Well, then they shouldn't have released them all few years of each other.
Because we're basically in 1982 now, and we will finish the season in 1984. So, yeah, they're pretty much back to back to back.
Yep.
So, but we are talking about 1990 Bronx Warriors. Oh, my son heard me listening to the soundtrack album the other day. This came out for Record Store Day about 10 years ago by Death Waltz Records. So I bought it at the time. I stood in line outside the record shop to hope that they didn't run out of copies. And then, like, 2 years later, I went back to the same record shop and they still had spare copies in the racks. Because, like, I'm the only person in my town that wants to buy a copy of the Bronx Warriors soundtrack. I was playing it the other day, and my son is doing music at college, and he's doing music technology, so he's always listening out for things he can sample. And somebody had mentioned how he should listen to Italian prog, so lately I've been just playing in bits of film music, and then he's putting it into stuff that he's making. So the other day he heard me listening to this and then immediately went and started sampling it and turning it into something. So if he's finished that by the time I edit this, I'll stick it on at the end of the episode.
Excellent.
Like a kind of dance remix of the theme. But yeah, this is, it's got great, we'll come to the music later when we go through all the, everybody behind this. But yeah, it's a very, very good, sort of distinctive theme. But anyway, yeah, Bronx Warriors, kind of a trilogy, but technically not a trilogy. It's not a trilogy.
Yeah.
The Enzo Castellari, I watched an interview with him where he said that he only thinks of them a trilogy because they were all made with the same producer. But basically, Bronx Warriors was written and designed to be a one-off. And then he immediately went on to do The New Barbarians, which is not in any way a sequel. And, I mean, we should probably do The New Barbarians on the podcast as well, because that is a post-apocalypse film.
Yeah, and it's thoroughly entertaining as hell.
Yeah. But whilst he was making that, Bronx Warriors was out and was a massive hit. And so that's why they said, oh, well, let's make a sequel. So Escape from the Bronx came about purely because this one was so successful. This wasn't designed to have a sequel. So they're thought of as being a trilogy, but it's technically just two films. If you think
and,
of...
Yeah, it's technically two films and The New Barbarians, yeah.
But yeah, so Bronx Warriors, what is your history with this film? Do you remember when you first saw it?
Oh my goodness, I think... well, no, I know for a fact. I back-checked. I read about this film for a while before I was able to actually see it. And of course, the original way I saw it was on a Doopie bootleg sometime in the 90s. You know, it's vague. I don't remember exactly when. But the point at which, and I loved it then. I knew it was an incredibly entertaining and well-strung together piece of entertainment back then. But then when it came out on DVD in the early 2000s here in the States, that's when I wrapped my arms and legs around it and said, "You're mine. I love you so much."
Yeah.
And so that's probably, you know, it was a slow, gradual realization of how this movie is both life-changing, life-affirming, and if you try to take it from me, I will scream bloody murder and bite at you. So
I was, as I've said many times, quite unaware of a lot of European cult cinema. And then about 12 years or so ago, Shameless, the DVD company over here, brought out the Bronx Warriors tin, like a collector's tin with a skull on the front, mm-hmm. with the three DVDs in. And I actually won that in a competition on a forum. Yeah. So there used to be a forum that would do competitions every week, and it was usually, the prizes were usually from Shameless or Arrow, and I won tons of stuff on that. I don't know why, I just got really good at winning their competitions.
Cool.
So so I won that. So that was the first time I saw it, and obviously I loved them, and that's why I bought the soundtrack album. Then I bought a Betamax copy, so I've got that somewhere, a UK Betamax release. Which I have signed by Enzo Castellari.
Cool.
I have met Enzo Castellari about 10 years ago.
I am envious, of course. Yeah.
I mean, it didn't go as well as I'd hoped. Basically, this was back when I was eagerly trying to interview everybody left, right, and center. And I'd arranged to do an interview with him at the Cine Access conference in London, where he was the guest of honor, and they were doing a screening of Bronx Warriors. And so I'd arranged that we would do the interview during the screening.
That was
kind of the plan.
You've told this story before, yeah.
Oh, have I? Yeah.
That didn't go.
It didn't work out. No, because I he just sat there and watched it. Actually, he was on his phone, which made me laugh. It must be the only time I've seen, you know, people being on their phone in the cinema is really annoying. But when it's the director of the movie, you have to worry. But yeah, so in the end, I had to leave. And he was still there, so the interview never happened. But I did get to say hello to him before the film, and he's signed that thing for me. And I took a photo of him as well, which I'll tweet out at some point. But so like you, the film's kind of life-changing. It's sort of, once you see it, you're hooked in.
Yeah.
I even, last year, I got the company that put out this book, which I'm going to refer to a lot in this season, Pulse Video, the French Blu-ray DVD restoration company, did a book last year called After the World Ends, When Post-Apocalyptic Movies Were Telling the Future. And mm-hmm. they put this book was out on Kickstarter last year, and I got the book with the Endgame soundtrack on vinyl and CD, and it's got the Endgame artwork on the front of the book. But I also got a T-shirt as well, so I've got a 1990 The Bronx Warriors in French T-shirt, which I feel like that's the ultimate obscure. If I'm walking around wearing that, nobody's going to come up to me and go, "Hey, Bronx Warriors," like, because not only is it as a film no one's heard of, it's in French, but it pleases me anyway.
It, as well it should, yes.
Yeah. So yes, like you, this film has made a big impact on me, and I've loved it ever since. In fact, although weirdly, the only thing I don't have is the Blu-ray. I've still just got the DVD tin. But I know it is out on Blu-ray in America. It hasn't been released over here, which sort of surprises me that no one's done it. But as far as I know, it's on Blu-ray in the States.
Yeah, the Blue Underground put it and its sequel and The New Barbarians all out on Blu-ray at the same time, which allowed them to kind of connect a bunch of the extras that are across all three discs, which is nice because that means that there are interviews with Castellari and the film's producer and several people involved in making the movies, and they kind of carry across the discs where they're focusing on each individual movie. It's pretty great. And Castellari and his son, who would spend summers on his father's film sets, and so he was he was 12 when they made the Bronx Warriors, and so he was there for a good chunk of the filming of this, and he's part of the commentary track as well along with David Gregory. And so it's a pretty darn good commentary track, and it's just I'm so glad that I'm always happy when these movies of this vintage and type get that kind of treatment and we're actually able to get in-depth thoughts from the people who made these movies. It's great.
Oh, I need to get those. You've convinced me.
Oh, it's wonderful. Yeah. Honestly, it'll only enhance your love of these movies. It's wonderful.
They are available. If anyone in the UK is listening who doesn't have the DVDs, they are available on Prime Video over here, I believe. But yeah, so unlike some of the films we're going to get to later on in the run, these films are pretty much very easy to see wherever you are. So Enzo Castellari, let's talk about him, shall we? As we just mentioned him,
I could talk about him for days. Yes.
Yeah. This is not his first mention on the podcast. We of course did the Heroin Busters not that long ago.
Yeah.
Which was great. He also had some involvement in The Humanoid, which we did back in season one. But apart from like those films, do you have sort of favorites of his other movies? I mean, he's done lots of great ones, obviously. But
I have so many favorites. First of all, once again, I'm going to take the opportunity to champion one of his early films from 1968, Johnny Hamlet, which is one of my favorite of his spaghetti westerns, and it's one that's very difficult to see. As easy as it is to see Any Gun Can Play, which he made the year before, I think Johnny Hamlet is one that really deserves a lot more attention, and I'm hoping that eventually one day it gets some kind of really wonderful release. Incredible.
I was going to say Kill Them All and Come Back Alone is such a great title for a spaghetti western.
Oh, it's a good film.
It's a fabulous title. Yeah.
Eagles Over London, Cold Eyes of Fear, love them. But it really, where I feel like we get to what I feel is he seems to be able to do almost anything he wants. He's not someone who's bound by a particular genre by any stretch. But once he started making those crime films that he was doing in the mid-70s, like High Crime and Street Law, The Big Racket, and Heroin Busters, you're all four of those are astonishingly good movies. They're fantastic films. Then you get, one of his late entry spaghettis, Kioma, which is a brilliant film. And then the film that everybody's going to know the title of at the very least, right there at the end of the 70s, he makes The Inglourious Basterds, and that's...
Which is really good.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But, I'm also a huge fan of the stuff. I love and I champion House by the Edge of the Lake, which, has been released now on Blu-ray, so there are more people who are aware of it, and it's very strange nature. It's well worth checking out.
Oh, no, I haven't seen that one.
Oh, really? House by the Edge of the Lake. I'm not going to say anything. I'm just going to say, okay. I think you will find it very interesting. The less you know about it going in, the more intriguing it is. It's a bit of an onion unraveling in front of you. It's pretty interesting.
Okay. He also, of course, did like everyone did in the 70s, a sexy period comedy, The Adventures of the Loves of Scaramouche, I think it is, with Ursula Andress. So,
that's one of the few of his I've not seen. No. I wonder why.
Yeah, we all know how Italian and Italian comedies play in your house.
They play to an empty room, yes.
And he did the Last Shark, which we almost got on Blu-ray from Severin, and then they had a cease and desist from Universal.
Oh, yeah.
I believe. But I just saw on Facebook. Was that the Last Shark? Is that the one that's the Jaws ripoff?
Oh yes, believe me, yes, it is.
But... But I did just see on Facebook that I think there's a French company that's about to put it out on Blu-ray. So that might be the only, if they get as far as being able to release it before they get a cease and desist, then we might get that on Blu-ray.
Yeah, I don't know.
But
I was thinking that it actually had been released, but no, I'm thinking of, there's the film Cruel Jaws, which used some footage from it, and Deep Blood did the same
Cruel
thing.
Jaws was the one where Severin did actually release it. And then got the cease and desist and had to stop it. But people did actually manage to buy it first, whereas The Last Shark, it got pulled before they even pressed it, I think. That whole area of just ripping off whatever is popular, and that's exactly why we're here with the Bronx Warriors.
Mm-hmm.
Which, in the interview I watched, he said that it was based on Escape from New York and Mad Max. Whereas there's an interview, which there's a bit of a elephant in the room there, which of course is the Warriors.
Very true.
There's an interview in this book with the script writer who does reference the Warriors as being also, because obviously it is. I mean, he's got to travel across New York and fight different
gangs.
Yeah, different gangs. So that's clearly the Warriors, and even obviously the clues in the name, but we like Enzo Castellari
a lot.
And in terms of other people that we might want to mention who were involved with the film, I mean, obviously Dardano
Sacchetti.
Yeah, in the book they interview Dardano Sacchetti, who wrote Bronx Warriors and Escape from the Bronx and Exterminators of the Year 3000 and Warriors of the Year 2072. So, he liked his futuristic action films with dates in the title.
I have a lot of time for him as a screenwriter because he was involved in a lot of movies that I really enjoy, all the way back to supposedly contributing to the stories for Cat of Nine Tails and Bay of Blood. So.
Oh, right. Wow. That is quite a heritage.
Yeah.
And these three films that Enzo Castellari did with the producer, who was Fabrizio De Angelis, and it was his idea. He loved New York and he loved the Bronx and this idea of it being a really violent place, and he also loved the Warriors. So it was him that said to Dardano Sacchetti that he wanted him to write a movie like The Warriors set in the Bronx. So it's pretty simple, which is why it's called Bronx Warriors. So it's about as basic as it gets. But then I think maybe later on those other elements of Mad Max and Escape from New York and things came in a little bit later, because this is not set in some kind of post-apocalypse. It's just a world where law and order in the Bronx has basically been written off, and the police are just leaving them all to it. You guys just do what you want, kill yourselves, we don't care. And so the gangs have taken over, which is where we've got the Riders and the Tigers. Is that right?
Yeah, and there are a few other gangs as well.
And then there's some smaller gangs, but they patrol. And the Riders are made up mainly of Hell's Angels, like real Hell's Angels.
Actual Hell's Angels, yes.
Which is great. There's some bits where they try and get some of the Hell's Angels to act. Which is pretty funny.
Doesn't quite work, but it does add something to the film. So,
and they've got great bikes. But did you notice? It's only the actors who get glowing skulls on their bikes, and all the Hell's Angels don't have skulls on their bikes, which I guess was for budgetary reasons, but sort of seems a shame.
It does seem a shame, or that, or perhaps the Hell's Angels are like, no, you're not messing with my bike at all.
Yeah, exactly. There's one shot as well where they're all riding along and all of the skulls glow, except one guy's, as clearly the batteries run out. But they're just like, oh, we haven't got time, just keep filming. But yeah, well, so the leader of the Riders is Trash. And Trash is, I think we've had a Trash Can before, haven't we? Played by Thomas Milian.
Yeah, that back in the crime season.
Yeah. And here we've got Trash, played by an actor credited as Mark Gregory,
mm-hmm.
but his actual real name was Marco Di Gregorio. And if you read on the IMDb, it says he was only 17, which is very hard to believe.
Yeah,
because it isn't true.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah,
He was 18, which is still very young to be that big, mm-hmm. and quite a responsibility to lead a film at that age. It's quite amazing.
Well, his story, you know, if you know his story, it is rather tragic. He did only do a few movies. By the late 80s, he had decided that being a movie actor was just not for him, and so he went back to his first love, which was painting. Apparently his father was a painter and an artist, so he went back to Italy and did that. But he kind of lost his way, had some real mental health struggles over his life.
Yeah. He also got scammed and like lost his house and everything.
Yeah.
He eventually died about 10 years ago,
mm-hmm.
of some kind of overdose in this little town where he'd moved to just outside Rome. And basically had a bit of a pauper's funeral. There was no family or anything.
Yeah, there's a you can see a photo of his I guess you would call it headstone there in Italy, and it's
You found that as well. I found that too. Yeah, it's on the. I'll put a link to this in the show notes. But the story of Mark Gregory is on the Cinema Italiano database, which is worth having a look at, where they've done a lot of research. Because for a long time, people just didn't know what happened to him. He kind of disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they kind of dug up the rather tragic story. And there are two different stories about how he got cast in this film. The one I'd heard was that Enzo Castellari went to the same gym, apparently. That was the story I'd heard, that they just saw him in the gym. But the other story is that his girlfriend sent a photo in to the casting when she heard about them casting this film. She sent his picture in, and he was chosen. So, which of those stories is true, I'm not entirely sure. But I like the idea of Enzo Castellari pumping iron down the gym in downtown Rome, and then spotting this massive 17-year-old and thinking, just who I'm looking for.
Yeah, I think that... I hope this is not considered to be in bad taste, but the idea... We should put forth that one of the things that may have contributed to his mental health problems is I think that he may have been fighting his sexuality throughout his life.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it seems pretty clear when you talk to people like Fred Williamson and other people that it was, you know, they knew he was gay. And one of the problems they had was trying to get him to present himself on screen in a way that did not look, at times, slightly effeminate. And you can,
oh, really?
Yeah, and you can spot some of those problems. Fred Williamson, in an interview, specifies how it took a while to get him to kind of have him find a way to show him how to walk across to, you know, there's that scene where they're out there at that. But you know, beside the river there in the Bronx.
That's a great scene.
Where he walks across, and Williamson talks about how they really had to spend a lot of time getting him to walk in a way where he did not look effeminate.
Oh, I see.
Yeah,
to try and make him be more macho.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
And so,
okay.
I see nowhere anyone talking about that as a contributing factor. And mm-hmm. you know, who knows? Maybe they're a bit off base, but. It is still one of those things where you see someone who had such potential, you know, for being someone. I mean, he did make, you know.
Yeah, he did a few other films.
He did about 10 films all told.
Yeah.
And whether or not you think of him as a particularly good actor, he still, you know, presents very effectively on screen. And it really is a shame that, you know, for whatever reason, that didn't work out. He didn't stick around in the industry, and I just I find it sad, but at the same time, I am glad that we do have, the three Thunder Warrior films, which I've only seen the first of, which is pretty entertaining. He's well cast in that. He's playing an American Indian in that, and he looks the part. But the tragedy of his life, in dying far too young. I mean, I think he was eight. I think he was only 48.
Right.
And it is a shame, but still, the tragedies. That's not the only tragic actor story in this film.
Well, quite. Yes, unfortunately so. Which we did mention a bit at the beginning, but yeah, basically this is, as far as I know, this was Vic Moreau's final completed film.
Before he there is a question. There's another film that came out in 82. I'm not sure one was shot.
Japanese. He appears to have been in some kind of Japanese war film that doesn't. On the IMDb, it doesn't have an English title, so I don't know if it only ever got released in Japan. And Vic Moreau had done a few Enzo Casolari films before this, so they obviously, he obviously felt he was very reliable and was very good at what he did and what he brought to it. But then, sadly, the year after this, he went straight from this to shooting the Twilight Zone movie.
And, of course, he died tragically in that helicopter accident.
A few years ago, I think when I learned about that, I read there's a book about the whole thing, which covers all the court, the trial and everything, and I read it, and it's such a depressing story.
Yeah.
It really is. It's so sad. And there was a documentary at some point on American television which actually showed the footage.
Oh, yeah. I remember seeing the footage at the time.
Yeah, it's actually on YouTube. There's a clip from that documentary where they go through and show you the... Because it was obviously being filmed from like five different angles, and that footage all was all evidence in court, and some of it's in this documentary, so you can actually see it. It's awful, and I regret watching it, but I did anyway, because you would I suppose, but yeah, really sad that Vic Moreau was killed with two children shooting the sequence for the Twilight Zone movie when there was an accident with a helicopter. Yeah, that's pretty bad. But he's a great, he's got great screen presence. He plays a good bad guy. He's a good baddie in this.
He was a very effective actor. He's one of those guys who has a very memorable face. Of course, for people like us, we'll remember him for films like this, and also, Bad News Bears and Humanoids from the Deep and just a lot of films like that. But I mean, he was in The Asphalt Jungle, and actually, as a knife wielding hoodlum, and that's where Castellari first saw him, and that's one of the reasons why he was so excited to be able to start casting him in a couple of films when he was able to, because he had firm memories of him from that movie, that small role there. A good solid actor.
Yeah, and a very familiar face on American TV as well.
Yeah.
Like, pretty much every show had him pop up in it at least once.
He was a bit of a TV star in the 60s. Yeah. He had his own TV series called Combat that was on, that, more than 150 episodes of that.
Yeah, I was thinking he was in Hogan's Heroes, but I must be getting that confused with Combat.
If he was, it must have just been a guest shot.
That's possible, I suppose. He's great in this as this kind of evil, not quite sure what he is. Well, we can get into that when we get to the plot, I suppose. The only other person behind the scenes I wanted to mention was, as I said at the beginning, the composer, who is Walter Rizzati. And mainly films I've never heard of, but the one that I think we will know that he did was The House by the Cemetery.
Yeah.
So that's perhaps his other well-known score outside of Italy. There are there's loads of Italian films that we've probably never heard of, but
of course he shared a credit on that with the screenwriter Dardando Sacchetti, who wrote the screenplays for House by the Cemetery and The Beyond, City of the Living Dead, and
of course. Excellent stuff. So shall we get to some plot? I mean, it's not much of a plot.
It's a pretty basic plot.
It's great, though. It's all the plot that you need, but yeah. Yeah. So I'm going to use the plot summary from the book. And what I like as well is the poster, the tagline, "The first to die were the lucky ones," which, again, doesn't really make sense.
And it doesn't fit the film. Not really.
Yeah, it doesn't work at all. The year, I feel like I should be reading this in like a trailer voice. The year is 1990. I can't do it. And we're in the United States. We're in the Bronx. It feels weird reading this not in an American accent as well. I'm just going to plow on. Following the explosion of crime and violence rates, the Bronx is officially declared an unsafe neighborhood. By decree, the authorities have renounced rule by law and order, abandoning its streets to chaos and its inhabitants to themselves. Gangs now control the area. The two largest are the Tigers, led by the Ogre. Why is he called the Ogre? That doesn't make a lot of sense to me. He's more like a king. When he meets what's his face later on, he calls him the King. So I don't know why he's called the Ogre. And the Ogre, his gang drive around in really nice classic cars,
mm-hmm.
and kind of dress like, I don't know, how would you describe their
style? They dress in what I would call flashy classic style clothes. I mean,
they basically dress like they're in a blaxploitation film.
Essentially, yeah. I mean, being led by Fred Williamson as the Ogre seems to have cascaded down to all of the fashion senses. So.
They're dressed like Black Caesar meets Superfly.
Mm-hmm.
Fred Williamson, because obviously he shot Black Caesar basically in the same place 10 years earlier or whatever, however long it was. And he talked about shooting in the Bronx was really cool. He says, "I have a lot of respect for that neighborhood. I also received a lot of help from the Hell's Angels, who also offered me their respect. So yeah, the Bronx was definitely cool." So I think the fact that they all recognize him as Black Caesar was probably quite handy.
Yeah. Well, that he was a, remember, Fred Williamson was also a football star in the 60s.
Well, yeah,
so they're going to be star. Members of that. They're going to be members of that motorcycle gang who remember him as the badass on the field as well.
That's true. And I'm sure I read somewhere, I can't remember where now, about how when they were filming in the Bronx, they were having to kind of pay protection and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
To local gangs and to like local real gangs and all that to stop them from nicking their equipment and all that. I'm sure I read that one somewhere.
Yeah. And they very smartly were able to get the Hell's Angels on their side. And so
because they're clearly using a lot of local people while they're filming. And then you've got the Riders led by Trash, young, massive hero. Who's not afraid to have his bare chest out through the whole movie? And why wouldn't you when you look as good as him?
Yeah, an incredibly handsome man. Yes.
Yeah, he's very good. And considering he'd never acted before. I mean, it's quite remarkable that he would be brave enough to take that on. That's got to be quite a big task.
Mm-hmm. He projects well on screen.
Yeah, he does do well. At nightfall, this is right at the beginning of the movie. At nightfall, a little rich girl flees Manhattan and its glass castles. She is, let's get her name right here. She is Anne, just plain old Anne,
mm-hmm.
Played by Stefania Goodwin.
Or Stefania.
Who is also
Stefania
Girolami. Yeah. She's Italian.
And if I'm not completely wrong, I think isn't she Enzo Castellari's daughter?
Oh, is she?
I don't know.
When you look at her credits, I think everything she's in is something he directed.
mm-hmm.
So very possibly then, yeah. She's even in Sinbad.
Oh, I know, the thing that he had to, he had to come in and attempt it. Yeah, I know, yeah.
Actually, I spoke to Luigi Cozzi about that. That's something you need to listen to. We talked about Sinbad, and he cleared up the whole thing.
Oh, that's fantastic. Good, good, good.
But yes, you could be right there, actually. But she's actually a director now. She mainly directs Italian television.
Mm-hmm.
But that kind of makes sense that she was not necessarily a professional actor. based on her performance. Not wanting to be cruel, but she's the less interesting person who takes up a lot of screen time in this
film.
Well,
she's also listed as an assistant director on this film and several other of her father's projects. So
she was quite busy. Mm-hmm. I mean, it makes sense if you, especially traveling over to New York, to have her, if she's around and she can assist and direct and she can be in front of the camera, that just saves a bit of time and space and money, doesn't it?
Very smart move.
She's the heiress of the Manhattan Corporation, the largest arms manufacturing firm on the continent. I don't know, it's hilarious that they're called the Manhattan Corporation.
I know. It's how much money? It's like, okay, we're already using the name the Bronx. How much? What word can we use it as even more identified with New York City?
Yeah. So she's run off to the Bronx because she knows the police won't come in to look for her. And in a tunnel, she falls into the hands of a gang of roller skating hockey players.
Straight out of the Warriors, yes.
Yeah, our first novelty gang, although not the best novelty gang in the film. But
That's an interesting conversation to have.
Well,
yeah.
My favorite novelty gang are the tap dancers.
Ah, well, okay.
We don't see enough of.
You're right.
I wanted to see more tap dance fighting. I think those guys are hilarious. But while she's fighting, she's being attacked by the roller skating hockey players. Rising from the shadows, Trash, leader of the Riders, comes to her rescue. Da 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 da. That's basically the setup. She doesn't tell him who she is for a while. She just tells him she wants to stay. So he's like, yeah, great. And then the next time we see her, she's got her own motorbike. So it didn't take long.
Yeah, there's a bit of a leap there in the relationship growth.
Yeah. 1 minute she's like this scared little girl. Next shot, she's got her own bike. But then in another shot, she's riding on the back of someone else's bike. So I'm not quite sure what the deal was there. But so this is the sort of setup that it turns out, yeah, she's this rich heiress. And the evil Manhattan Corporation want to get her back. So they hire Vic Moreau, who is like, it's kind of like ex-police or something. Although he seems to have, but he seems to have control. He's able to, by the end of the movie, he's able to just bring in mounted police.
Which is very strange. Yeah, I know. It's one of those things where he seems to still actually be affiliated with the police.
Yeah. And he's called Hammer, which made me laugh, given obviously this film's got Fred Williamson in it.
Oh, I know, and which is also that was Fred Williamson's nickname.
Yeah, he was the Hammer, wasn't he?
Right, which is confusing. It wasn't confusing. It's not going to be confusing for people who are unaware of much about Fred Williamson, but for anyone who is, you're going, wait a minute. So he's called the Ogre, and there's another character called Hammer. What in hell is going on? Yeah.
And he's got a friend Hammer has got a friend who drives a big rig, which for some reason he's decided he's going to use that as his getaway vehicle, like the most conspicuous massive truck riding through the Bronx. But Hammer's using this as his mobile base of operations.
Yeah.
And I think his friend is called Hot Dog, I think.
Yeah,
that's his.
Yeah, nobody has real names. And the actor who plays the actor who plays Hot Dog is Christopher Connolly, who's another, you know, I hate to put it bluntly, but he's another actual actor who's in this movie.
He's a very familiar face.
Bajillion films. We'll encounter him again. We'll encounter him again later on this particular season.
Yeah. Yeah, he's just one of those guys who, actor for hire, he'll be in anything if you're paying him.
He was in every television show that existed in the 70s, and he's also one of my all-time shameful loves, which is a film I know is not good from 1978 called The Norseman, that stars Lee Majors and a bunch of football players as Vikings. I can't defend it. I won't defend it, but I have watched it more than I should. But Christopher Connolly's in that.
Yeah. I know how you feel about Vikings.
Yes, yes.
There's nothing wrong with that.
It's hard to defend it in any way, shape, or form. But yeah. Christopher Connolly, you know, fans of what we're into would notice that he sure. He was in Lucio Fulci's film Manhattan Baby. And you know, he beside and like I say, we'll see him in Atlantis Interceptors later in the season. But he's an actual good solid actor who is on screen in a zillion television episodes.
And he's actually got quite a good role in this. He's not just one scene and done. He's all the way through pretty much.
Yeah.
So he's helping out Hammer because Hammer is paying him. Although he also seems to owe him a favor or something.
Something.
They have some kind of complex past that's not fully explored.
But the film seems to think that it is. That's the weird thing, is there's this assumption made where it almost feels like there's a dropped line of dialogue somewhere that would make us understand exactly why he feels so compelled to stick around at times.
I know, it's like, what are you doing? Just get out of here with your massive truck. And also popping up later on in the film is the leader of the... It's really weird. So I think he's the leader of the hockey-playing gang, but he's dressed like some kind of Japanese samurai, is George Eastman, who... As we've talked about him, he's popped up on the podcast before. He would do anything because he was spending his money gambling as faster than he could earn it. So he would turn up in any movie. It didn't matter. Is it good? Doesn't matter. Is it porn? Don't care. Just
does the script need a touch up, or do you need a script from the bottom up?
I'll write it. That's fine.
Here's how much money I need to do that, and I will do that as well. Yeah.
He even directed, didn't he, George Eastman?
You know, I'm not sure. I know he definitely wrote a number of films, yeah.
We should say his real name, because he was credited as either George Eastman or Luigi Montefiore.
Mm-hmm.
And he's still alive and regularly pops up in interviews on extras, which is nice. But yeah, he, like you said, he wrote tons of stuff.
Yeah.
But he has actually directed, apparently. In fact... 2020 Texas Gladiators. He's one of the directors associated with that. So,
I know he wrote 2020 Texas Gladiators. He's listed as the writer on that under a pseudonym. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think he's uncredited according to the IMDb, which who knows how accurate that is. I did just watch recently Caligula: The Untold Story, which he wrote.
Me too. Yeah.
And he's written a whole bunch of this stuff. He wrote the film, which is weirdly on YouTube in a terrible quality copy. He wrote the film called Bestialita, which is about a girl who is traumatized because she saw her mum having sex with the family dog.
Oh my god!
And then the dad comes home, catches them at it, and then locks the dog in the house and then burns the house down.
Oh my god.
That's the opening scene. How it starts. Yeah, that's how it starts.
Oh my god, is that the film known as
Dog Lay Afternoon apparently, which,
oh my god,
yeah. Yeah. The dad burns the house down in the opening credits. Anyway. So George Eastman, as you said, he needed the money, he'd do whatever he liked. It didn't matter. Mm-hmm. But, you know, God bless him, because it means he pops up in all kinds of interesting places.
Yeah, thank goodness. And he's always a welcome sight in any of these movies. I mean, he was this very tall, athletic man who project, you know, he talk about projecting well. There's a similar form of the camera kind of really being a good place for him to be in front of. Yeah. I mean, there's much like the we talk about Mark Gregory in this. It is a similar thing there with George Eastman. It's just that George Eastman, you know, either loved making films and being in front of the camera and behind it, or as we both know, that gambling problem. This was like, gotta have money, gotta have money, gotta have money.
But he could be, you know, as well as doing all this kind of exploitation stuff, and, you know, he was quite good at gurning when he needed to, but he could also actually be a very good actor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, you know, we talked about him in the Poliziotteschi season because of his role in Rabid Dogs.
Yeah.
And he's very good in that. Like, properly, he's really acting and is very good.
I've never seen George Eastman. I mean, he's a little over the top in this, but he's giving exactly what the role requires.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, exactly. It's not as if he's doing something that stands out as silly, no. You know, surrounded by other thespians. It's not that he's doing what's required of him by the type of story being told.
He's quite infamous in this country because he appeared in a couple of films that were on the banned Video Nasties list as well.
Oh, really? Yeah, I guess. Yeah. Well, I guess that has to be true. I think
Absurd, and Anthropophagus were on the list.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, those are a couple of nasty little movies that he's at the center of. So
yeah, and we're going to see him at least two more times, I think, in this season. But yeah, so he's the leader of that gang, and at one point there's a fight between him and the ogre. Which, of course, the ogre is the hero, so we can probably guess how that goes. But it's really weird that you've got this ice hockey gang being led by a samurai. None of it makes any sense.
There's a question that never seems to be asked, which is, you know, how were these costuming choices made?
I know.
Enzo, like, please tell us how this went down, you know.
It's basically like they watched the Warriors and they went, yep, we'll have that one. We like that one. Oh, let's take that, but push it a bit more.
I mean, the
tap dancing gang are just fabulous. And I would like to see more of them. It's disappointing that they're only in it for one scene. And they're led, again, like they're a bunch of tap dancers, but they're led by a woman called the Witch for some reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She's not tap dancing.
But that actress is like a choreographer, and it's clear that she's a dancer in the one scene that she's in. It's like this woman knows what she's doing. You know?
And you just think, with the rest of the time, when they're not fighting, they're just churning out fabulous routines.
Mm-hmm. Apparently, so that would be the training, so, right?
Yeah. So Hammer is coming into the Bronx to try and rescue Anne. So Trash decides that what they're going to have to do is team up with the ogre to take down, because otherwise they're going to destroy the Bronx. I think that's basically what they've realized. They've all got to team up and put aside their petty squabbles and territory issues in order to fight back. So this is where it gets like the Warriors, and he's got to travel through the Bronx, aka the abandoned factories of Rome. Which is great. I mean, it's, you know, it's good. It looks good on screen. I'm sure at one point he's actually in Roman ruins. Like, there's none of.
Oh yeah, well, there's a great scene in the movie where, if you listen to the commentary track with Castellari and his son, it's really great, because it's the scene where they burn the two dead bodies that the two people that Vic Morrow kill on the staircase with a shotgun. Where they kind of Viking funeral them, and Castellari actually is sitting there watching, saying, "Okay," so, you know, he starts going, "Okay," he says, "this shot's in the Bronx, this shot's in Rome, this shot's in the Bronx, this shot's in Rome," and it's this brilliant editing back and forth, and it all looks like it's all taking place in one shot, because he knew what he was doing as a director. And it just, and if he wasn't sitting there doing it, you would just assume that all of this was shot in one location, but it wasn't. It's really amazing. Yeah.
I mean, a lot of the Bronx stuff that is clearly the Bronx, it was so run down.
Mm-hmm.
And there are buildings that are just burned out and trashed, and there's piles of rubble everywhere. But then they do a really good job of intercutting that with roaming around abandoned factories in Rome. For a lot of the other stuff, and they sort of, like you said, they cut between the two. The sequence when I don't think we're spoiling it too much, but towards the end, Hammer brings in the big guns, which is actually mounted police with flamethrowers.
Yeah, and the flamethrower effects are clever as hell.
I mean, is it safe to have a flamethrower on a horse? That was my first question. Like, what are they doing?
Probably not. No.
They've got horses running through abandoned factories full of holes in the floor. And there's somebody on the back firing flames off at extras. It just seems mad. Whilst Vic Morrow stands at the top laughing insanely. Mm-hmm. It's really quite impressive. But yeah, like you said, the combination of Rome shooting and Bronx shooting is very well done. But yeah, they're sort of traveling through and they meet all these different gangs. There's one gang who apparently have reverted back to some kind of primitive state, mm-hmm. and they just communicate in grunts and all wear sack, which was really weird.
I know, and they paint themselves in some bizarre tribal fashion. It's strange, yeah.
And yeah, so it's just lots of fighting, different gangs. Is Trash going to convince the ogre to join him? Well, you know, probably.
But still, you know, let's not, it's give it just away.
Yeah, I love it. It's so good.
Well, I got to tell you this. This kills me. There's I am making my poor beloved Beth watch this with me about a week ago.
I would say lucky Beth.
Well, you know, she did end up enjoying it. Don't get me wrong, but she's a great barometer for what a normal audience member would be thinking. And of course, one of the things I don't remember them all. I should have written more of them down, honestly. But there were points at which where what she was saying is just a normal logical thing. She says, "Wait, we're in New York City. Why aren't these idiots carrying guns?" Are the guns? Why aren't they carting guns around? And it's like, yeah. I mean, what they seem to be getting across without stating it is that there's been some kind of lockdown on guns, so it's difficult for the gangs to get their hands on those kind of weapons. And that's why the cops are the ones who, when they come in, they're actually wielding guns, and they're so devastating. But
in the poster, in the American poster, Trash is wielding some kind of massive semi-automatic or something. I know what you mean. In the sequel, I think in Escape from the Bronx, there's more actual shooting around, isn't there? There's more gunfire between the... I think they have got guns in that one. But yeah, that is a very good point.
Yeah,
It's gone kind of feudal, like a bit sort of medieval.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's not... like I say, they're trafficking heavily in kind of what was true in... Escape from New York, which was, you know, those people in there in general didn't have guns, because if they had guns for a while, after a few years, they didn't have any ammunition. They didn't have the ability to repair those things. You know, they didn't have the things necessary to maintain that as a bit of the kind of criminal infrastructure of the place, which, okay, that would make sense. No problem. Gotcha. But here it's just, you know, can you drive down to New Jersey and get you some guns? Yeah. I mean, just,
well, it seems like they can't get off. It isn't suggested, but it seems like they can't leave the Bronx.
Yeah. It seems like there's some kind of way that they are being kept from exiting. So, but it's never made completely clear. Yeah.
If only Trash knew somebody who was about to inherit a fortune because she was the heiress of the largest arms manufacturing firm in America.
Talk about a thread that never gets pulled. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, she could have got them all the weapons they wanted and had a really big shootout finale that they couldn't afford, I suppose.
Of course, the other brilliant thing that Beth pointed out at a certain point was, okay, so not giving any, you know, not giving too much away here, but at a certain point, Trash enlists Ogre and his main badass female henchman, the whip-wielding lady.
Oh, yes. She's cool.
She's
what's
amazing.
Her name? I've forgotten. Well, was she the witch? No, she wasn't the witch, was she? I forget which one she is.
Oh, yeah, she was referred to as the witch.
Is she the witch? Yeah. Yeah, she's the witch.
Yeah.
It was somebody else that led the tap dancers then. Anyway.
Yeah, I can't remember the...
Yes, you're right. So she was the witch... And she's dressed like she's going to some kind of S&M party.
yes.
And this was her only film.
Which is a shame, because she really is fun in this movie. She's a blast. But nevertheless, so at one point, you know, the three of them are threading their way through, you know, the ruins of the Bronx, going on their trip there. And Beth is going... Why are there just the three of them? I mean, Fred Williamson has like two dozen people. Why aren't there like more people going with them? And because
they were in New York and the other three were in Rome.
Yep, pretty much. That's the way it goes, unfortunately.
Yeah,
but the
Fred Williamson's gang in New York had all brought their own clothes. so they didn't have those costumes in Rome to give to some other locals to try and pretend that they were part of the same gang.
Probably not.
Yeah. Actually, I just found in the book, as I mentioned before, about the trouble they had on the set, and I might have been wrong there. So I just want to clarify that before we finish. According to the book, it says that when they were filming in New York, the police were supervising, but the police basically monitored the proceedings from the interior of their cars. Mm-hmm. So there were police keeping an eye on the shoot, but they didn't get out their cars. They just right. sat in the cars and watched.
Well, Casolari tells the funny story of, you know, the cops, when the cops would get out to like go get some coffee or to get their lunch, they would like carry their shotguns with them.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine. Yeah. And there's some good stuff, although the police are not allowed into the Bronx, or they've just left it in the movie. But there's one scene, there's a couple of scenes where the police are flying over with their helicopter, and they're like, and then there's another scene where the police are driving through in a kind of armored van, and a member of Trash's gang jumps onto the back of the van and then spray paints graffiti on the window. I mean, it all feels, although obviously the film is set in 1990, that was only like 9 years away from when they were shooting.
Yeah.
And it must have felt, for many people, especially if you were in the audience in a cinema in the Bronx watching this film, it must have felt like it was actually quite a good kind of commentary on what life was like for people who lived there, and that kind of antagonism with local law enforcement and all that stuff.
Honestly, it feels like a really great little window into the early 80s Bronx there's no way to refer to it as a documentary, but it is this amazing way of seeing this stuff without it being, you know, linked in with, you know, some kind of news or documentary footage. It's what was really there, and that the reason they're there filming in the first place is because it looks that way. So it's kind of it's kind of fascinating.
It is this great shots of New York and great shots of Manhattan across the river.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite scene, I think you mentioned it briefly, is when a member of Trash's gang has been killed by the Ogre's gang, the Tigers. And they kind of meet, the two gangs meet. You've got all of the bikers, and they're all lined up in this kind of really cool zigzag formation, all the bikes, all the Hell's Angels. And then all these classic cars come in with all these guys in their great suits. And the whole scene is underscored by just a guy playing the drums in the corner.
Yeah, who's just kind of
patch of wasteland.
Apparently that's just his location to like play the drums for a good long while.
He just drums all the way through this whole thing, and the way that it's shot and edited, the scene starts with these brilliant close-ups of him playing, and it intercuts close-ups of him and the drums with close-ups of Trash and the gang. It's such a great sequence, and I would like every dramatic moment in my life to be accompanied by a drummer in the corner of the just free playing away in the corner.
Just as an underscore, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Just providing some rhythmical accompaniment to my problem moments. But yeah, I love that. It's so kind of random. Just there's a drummer in the wild. It reminds me, and I don't know whether Casolari did this on purpose, but in Jean-Luc Godard's Weekend, there is a scene where, because I watched this when I was at college and it always stuck with me, there's a scene where they're walking through the woods, these kind of rebels in the woods with their weapons, and there's a really cool drum beat on the soundtrack, and you're just like, oh yeah, presuming this is just part of the soundtrack. But they're walking along and the camera just pans and there's a drummer in the trees and then they just walk past and it just keeps panning, and you're like, hang on, what? Why is that guy in the trees playing the drum? You know, it's kind of like when, it's in Blazing Saddles, Mel Brooks does the same gag with Count Basie and his orchestra.
Yeah.
Where you hear this great score and the camera pans across and there's just Count Basie and his orchestra in the desert, where the music goes from non-diegetic to diegetic. And I really like that. That's sort of, I don't know if what exactly was on the minds of Casolari or whoever's idea this was to just have a drummer in the corner. But it's so great. It just adds a whole new interesting dimension to that entire encounter, and it means that the editing is on all the close-ups and everything, it fits to the rhythm, It's almost, it's like a kind of, it's like jazz almost, jazz mm-hmm. editing. It's great. I really like it. It's one of the things that for me makes this film stand out, is that, because it didn't have to, you know, that didn't have to be there. The drummer didn't have to be part of that scene at all, but it makes no bearing on the plot at all. But it just makes it so cool.
Mm-hmm. It's another little element that just adds to, you're right, the cool factor is probably the best way to put it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I play the drums myself, so maybe that's another reason why I pick up on that.
I mean, it stands out in this film. It is something that it's hard to miss. If you're, you know, it's amazing.
It's very cool.
Before we leap away from this, I do want to point out that I've kind of held this in reserve, because this to me was a truly shocking bit of information as I delved into the cast and crew of this film. There's a character we haven't spoken about.
Oh, go on.
Who's known as Ice in the movie.
He is great.
Uh-huh. Well, he's played by an actor named Joshua Sinclair. Now,
yeah, what I like, just maybe you're going to mention this, but I like the fact that the rest of the gang have all got long hair and look like bikers. And then he's got just like short hair and glasses and looks like he's an accountant for the gang the rest of the time.
Yes, exactly. Here's the thing. He is a unique individual, because not only did he act in about 24 films and television projects over the years. I mean, he was in Inglorious Bastards and Heroin Busters and Hitchhike and Kioma and The Big Racket. So obviously he and Castellari were big buddies. He had a role in Lady Frankenstein in the early 70s. But the real shock is that he appears to have been an actual, no joke, medical doctor.
Oh.
Yeah, who specialized in tropical diseases. He appears to have worked, at least in affiliation, with Mother Teresa a couple of times in Calcutta and Bombay, as well in various parts of Africa. May have been, from what I can read in a couple of different places, a professor in comparative theology at one point. worked with several nonprofits, which is where the Calcutta and Bombay stuff came into play. But he also was a novelist. He wrote movies. He ended up producing movies. He ended up writing and directing a movie that was called A Rose in Winter, that came out in 2018.
Oh, right.
Okay. Which recounts the story of Edith Stein. Won awards for that. It is very highly regarded as a solid, good movie. He wrote and directed it. It's kind of astonishing when you look at this guy who's playing this nasty bad guy in this movie.
Yeah. With his Nazi regalia.
Yeah, but as far as films are concerned, apparently he wrote... He wrote Shaka Zulu for television. He wrote Just a Gigolo in 78. Judgment in Nuremberg, or I'm sorry, not Judgment in Berlin from 1988. He's credited for having written the screenplay for that. It's a little odd. I mean, it's
wow.
You don't expect. I mean, clearly he was paying attention while he was making movies, while he was doing the acting that he did in the especially in the 80s. So he learned. Apparently worked pretty regularly, was a published novelist, and what can you say? Joshua Sinclair, hidden talents in this guy.
Very interesting.
Yeah, very strange.
Yeah, the thing that just stuck out for me was how he didn't look like he really fitted in with the gang at all. But that's actually the least interesting thing about him. How cool.
Yeah.
There you go.
Very strange to see something like that turn up.
Yeah,
where you're
you
just
never know.
Yeah, and he was an American. He was apparently a New York City native. So at whatever point in the 70s when he hooked up with, when he started making films, when he started being an actor, the first credit of his is a Vittorio De Sica film. The Garden of the Finzi Contini's. I've never seen the film, but I know the name.
Okay.
But yeah, that I'm wondering if he was just a film nut and decided to start playing around in it, and that's how he ended up in a bunch of different roles. I don't know, but he seems like an incredibly fascinating man.
Wow. Well, and you know, just for being in Lady Frankenstein, he would earn undying respect.
Exactly.
That's really funny. Well, there you go. That's a good positive note to end on. So do join us next time, where we will be moving forwards from 1990 to the year 2020 with the Texas Gladiators, which and then we're going to be, which is 1983, which is where we will be for quite a long time. But it wasn't a bad year, so that's not
Bad. But I mean, the real joy, and this is something I wonder if this is how you think of this. For me, the real meat of the Italian post-apocalyptic stuff is anything that is really trying to ape the Road Warrior. Don't get me wrong, I love it when they try to ape the Warriors and Escape from New York as well. But as soon as we're out in the desert, you know, driving cars really fast in a reckless fashion, I'm pretty happy, and I'm loving it just on the basis of those elements alone. So I think for the rest of this season, we're kind of comfortably in that area, mostly, not completely, but mostly.
Yeah, so. the apocalypse has truly happened by for most of the rest of the season. That's true.
Yeah.
Well, thank you everybody for listening. If you want to get in touch with us. We do have an email, which I have to confess I haven't actually looked at for about 3 months.
Oh my goodness.
So if you've emailed us and I haven't replied, that's why. But I, now that I've said this out loud, I will actually have a look.
you'll be shamed into checking it.
But we're also on Twitter. That's the main way to get in touch with us, or also on Instagram. All the links are in the show notes. If you want to buy us a virtual coffee, you can also do that. And we just we just like to hear from you. Basically, if you've got favorite post-apocalypse films, then we'd like to know what those are as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's all from me. Rod, anything you want to add before we finish?
No, I just like to thank everybody for tuning in. I do get the occasional little nod from people here and there saying that they enjoy the show, and that there's certain films that they're happy to have someone discussing one way or the other. And I have the feeling that this particular season we're in the middle of will be one that will garner a good deal more attention as well, just because of the extreme popularity of this particular strange genre.
Yeah, exactly. And and particularly with some of the later ones, they're fairly obscure and not that many people probably make the effort to talk about them in any kind of recorded setting. So so we're definitely, hopefully we're producing some vital work here on these neglected films. But obviously not this one. Everyone knows this film, but
apparently,
anyway,
yeah.
I'm getting ahead of ourselves here. I'm mainly thinking of A Man Called Rage and The Final Executioner, if I'm honest.
Well, but, I've got to say, when I look at that list of the films that we're going to be, you know, that we're going to be messing around with, A Man Called Rage is the one that stood out as me not being able to recall if I've seen it. So
yeah, oh good. I'm glad. It's always good if we can get at least one of those.
Yeah.
anyway, right. Thanks everybody for listening, and we will be back again soon in the future. Bye for now.
Bye, everyone.